Stay tuned for The Cinema Clash, as Maryland-based critics Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl debate the merits of new releases, from the mainstream movies that Hannah tends to favor to obscure foreign films that Charlie likes to champion. It's free-flowing, unedited conversation with an occasional wine wager. Two very different perspectives, one entertaining podcast. Let the clash begin.
Hello and welcome to another Quarren Stream edition of the Cinema Clash. I am Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net, joined ever so remotely by my ever so remote co-host Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com for a quick chat about some new releases, including Trial of the Chicago 7 on Netflix, Honest Thief with Liam Neeson, an indie darling called, I hope I can say this, Shit House, a documentary called Fly Like a Girl, a mockumentary called John Bronco, and maybe some other stuff too that chances are I saw and maybe Charlie Jewell, you did not.
There's a good chance I didn't see anything that that you're talking about, because you're watching Middleburg Film Festival films because it's virtual this year, and I decided, no, I'm done with virtual film festivals for now. I decline. So you got a lot of heavy lifting on your part in the future.
I didn't even mention the Middleburg Film Festival.
But I know you've been watching it, and you're starting to rack and stack those tallies there.
But some of these others you could have watched. They were available to you.
I watched the vast majority of the same things that you watched this week. We overlap very well. But this is not one of those. We watched seven things, but one of us watched three, one of us watched four. No, we actually overlap on three things this week. We're going to do very well. We're going to have lively discussion, because I already know there's at least one of them we sort of disagree about.
That's true. And, you know, the big three, I would say, we both did see. So let's kick it off with, what do you think, Trial of the Chicago 7?
I think we should, because not only is it the most easily readily available, it's on Netflix. It started today. It started today, Friday, October 16th. You can go watch it right now. It's got the biggest cast, certainly a huge ensemble cast full of A and B list actors that everybody knows. I don't think it has a trial that everyone's ever heard about. I think we've all maybe heard of the slogan, the Chicago 7. But before this film, I couldn't have told you beyond Abbie Hoffman, I think, any of the other six at all. I didn't know why they were charged. I didn't know how that trial went. I didn't know the outcome. They don't teach this stuff in school, Hannah. And I was minus 12 when it went down. So no, I didn't know anything about it. I learned a lot from the new Aaron Sorkin film. So tell us, Hannah, who's on trial? Who are these Chicago men?
Well, and the Chicago 7 actually started as the Chicago 8. And then there was this other guy, Bobby Seale, whose trial ended up being sort of separate, and he had a mistrial declared. But he's in that film as well, and he's got a very, very good subplot story of his own. So even though it's Trial of the Chicago 7, there are eight guys involved. And basically, they were all organizers of a protest outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, which I do think most people have heard about. Like, you remember hearing about the upheaval and the protests and just how the city became just a battleground between demonstrators and the cops in Chicago, law enforcement. So I knew vaguely that something happened with the 68 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, but I certainly was not aware of this trial that really was railroading these organizers. And Abbie Hoffman is the only name that I really knew. And having Sacha Baron Cohen playing Abbie Hoffman was actually, I think, pretty good casting in this Aaron Sorkin dialogue-driven film.
It was bold, very bold casting. This is a courtroom thriller. It's also a dramatic reenactment cut directly with documentary footage. So they'll actually show, they'll reenact, this is what it looks like with people getting their skulls bashed in with a police baton, and cut to the black and white real footage of, there he is, getting his head blown open. We learn about the Students for a Democratic Society, fronted by Tom Hayden, played by Eddie Redmayne. We learn about the Yippies. That's Abbie Hoffman. And we learn about the National Mobilization Committee to End the War in Vietnam. That was David Dellinger. We learn about David Dellinger. And the others are just scattershot. We learn about Judge Julius Hoffman, played by Frank Langella. This man was very confident in his display of judicial bias and the more than overt tone and atmosphere of political pressure present in the courtroom. They didn't really hide it. One of the prosecutors, the lead prosecutor, they have played by another sort of bold choice, Joseph Gordon-Levitt. You could tell he's conflicted, but at the end of the day, he's a company man. But this is Aaron Sorkin, and Aaron Sorkin loves him big speeches. This is West Wing Aaron Sorkin. He won an Oscar for adapted screenplay. He adapted The Social Network, known for its speeches. He was nominated for Moneyball. He was nominated for Molly's Game. He'll be nominated for this, but I think just for writing. One common criticism when it comes to Sorkin is that he should not direct his own material. His words are stronger in other hands. And Hannah, I want your gut reaction to that. Do you agree with that? Is he a better writer than director? Or, you know what? People don't know what they're talking about. Of course he can direct his own words.
I absolutely believe that he should not be directing his own words because I think back to Molly's Game. This is really only the second one that he's directed and written. The first being Molly's Game from a couple of years ago that I felt suffered from exactly the same thing that was slightly off-putting to me with Trial of the Chicago 7, which is still an excellent, you know, film and very well written and has just an incredible cast. But it just, it's sort of a little heavy-handed on the preachiness sometimes because it's trying to give each individual their moment to shine. But when I look at The American President and The West Wing and Sports Night, and The Social Network and Moneyball, and I saw To Kill a Mockingbird on Broadway, which Aaron Sorkin adapted for theater. And, you know, I just think he's a better writer than director. And I do not think it serves this film well, because I think it's another one of those ones where, yes, nominate him for best screenplay because the written words are great. But I don't think it's all that well directed. And there are points where, I don't know, it just the rest of it can't live up to the script and the dialogue.
I do not know which parts of the script are embellished and invented for the screen. I know some are, and which ones are immediately accurate to true life. I just wasn't there. I don't know, and I haven't read the long-form magazine articles that parse it out yet. What I did notice, a quirk maybe, a coincidence, I don't know. Why are there so many British actors? Redmayne passes. His American accent is fine. I've heard it before. Sacha Baron Cohen is doing some sort of a Boston accent mixed in with his British. And then there's Mark Rylance as lead counsel William Kunstler, also with a shaky accent. Hannah, why am I looking at a British film here?
I think it's just because they were trying to find just actors who could deliver that dialogue. And then Michael Keaton's in there too, though, as Ramsey Clark, as a sort of witness for the defense. So you cannot ask for a better cast. So I don't think it's, I certainly didn't even think about the fact that some of these guys were British. I think it's a mix. I love Eddie Redmayne in just about anything. This was a very different kind of role for him than I've seen lately. I liked it for really getting a grasp of the story itself. And certainly right now when politics is a hot potato, this really spotlights this mix of cynical and serious philosophical and political debate. It really still kind of resonates today. And so, you know, anything that Aaron Sorkin does almost always is going to involve politics and history and strong characters and social justice. And so for that alone, it's worth seeing. I just didn't think it's a great film.
I think it's a very good film. There are very strong comparisons to 2020. In fact, I think most of them unintentional, because this was shot before most of the stuff kicked off. There's an alleged Law and Order candidate. There are scary mentions of others taking to the streets and disrupting your values. There's police versus citizens. Very strong theme in this film, resonating today. I don't think Sorkin meant all of those to mirror each other. That just happened. But all in all, I think this is a very, very strong tale of political revenge that sends its message loud and clear. I'm on board the trial of the Chicago 7.
Yeah, I don't think it hurts anyone to see it. And it's a good little history and political lesson for all those homeschooled kids out there.
No, I don't want the kids watching this, though.
All right. Maybe for the homeschooled, for all the college kids who are just trying to find something informative to watch.
All right. For our next film, man, I got excited, Hannah. I'm not going to lie. I got excited. I saw that my boy Liam Neeson was in it, and I like most of the stuff Liam Neeson does. And this looks like this was a standard Liam Neeson movie poster. He's got a gun in his hand and stuff is flashing by. Something's gonna happen. And then it starts. Oh my gosh, the first like 3 minutes, he's robbing banks, Hannah. This is gonna be great. Liam Neeson's robbing banks. Someone pop the popcorn, turn the lights down. This is great. And then he falls in love and he calls the FBI and he says, I want to turn myself in his American accent. He wants to strike a deal. He will return all the money he stole, every last cent. He didn't spend any of it, for a reduced sentence in a prison close to home. And he gets double-crossed. Evil, bad FBI agents find the money, steal the money, pin it on him, murder another FBI agent, pin it on
him. Hey.
No, that is right.
No spoilers.
No, that is not a spoiler. He's trying to clear his name. Watch the preview. The guy's murdered. I'm not telling you who's murdered. It's garbage. This stupid movie, Honest Thief, is about him. Oh man, when I thought it was about robbing banks, I thought we had something. But no, it's about him clearing his name because the FBI agents stole his money and he can't turn himself in. It's terrible. This is written and directed by Mark Williams, known as more of as a producer. He produced The Accountant, if you remember that, with Ben Affleck. He produced Ozark on Netflix with Jason Bateman and Laura Linney, which was nominated for about 1.5 million Emmy Awards. He directed a film I never saw in 2016 called The Family Man, starring Gerard Butler. This is one of perhaps the worst Liam Neeson movie ever made, Hannah.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's probably true. I love a good Liam Neeson film as well. These thriller action things, it is Liam Neeson. But this film has a paper-thin plot that just doesn't really work. And it almost felt to me more like a cable television movie rather than a Liam Neeson movie. And even just right down to the love interest, it's Kate Walsh that folks would recognize from Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice. That's really where she's most well known, and she's fine in this, but it's like she's certainly not, as recognizable as a Liam Neeson or as an action star. And the reason I thought my mind immediately went to both White Collar and Burn Notice, which were on USA. This felt a lot like a crossover episode of those two programs. But those two programs were actually better. And one of the FBI agents people will recognize from Burn Notice, Jeffrey Donovan, plays a conflicted FBI guy. So it just, this material fails Liam Neeson big time. I think that's ultimately what happened, because Liam is Liam. He's always watchable. I just was really disappointed in what I saw.
Tom Carter, who Liam Neeson plays, decides to turn himself in before telling the woman he is so madly in love with and wants to buy a house with and wants to spend the rest of his life with. He picks up the phone to the FBI in a hotel room, says, come and get me, before he tells her. That's just sloppy writing. Weren't they together for like a year? Yeah, and he's saying he's doing this for her so he can start over with a clean slate without this guilty conscience weighing on him, which he'd only developed after he met her because he wasn't looking too guilty beforehand. And oh my gosh, this is so poorly written. I hate everything about this stupid movie.
It was very poorly written, and so much of it was predictable in its own way in terms of what was happening with the relationship and just the miscommunication. And once she finds out, is she going to stand by him and all of that kind of stuff? Is she going to believe that he's innocent in the, you know, when he's double crossed by these FBI guys? But there was even a scene where I thought she had figured it out. I thought she was sort of trying to throw off the FBI guys. And then you're supposed to actually believe that, no, she actually really thought they were friends of Tom's. And I'm like, did I just miss something here? Are you like totally, totally just an idiot?
And the bad guy, which is not a spoiler, it's not a spoiler, you know, very early. It's like he was waiting for his chance. Yeah. Like he was born a bad guy. He has no motivation. He has no backstory. He's just waiting for his opportunity to get rich quick, to steal. And he had this prepared speech for his weak-willed, very bendable partner who spends the rest of the film pouting. He's your boy from Hamilton, by the way, Anthony Ramos.
Anthony Ramos, yeah.
The pouter. And another guy, your boy from Burn Notice, I guess, just spends the whole time talking to his dog that he just wanted a divorce. And I don't even know why. Like, all he does is talk about this divorce that has nothing to do with the movie. Yeah. Has nothing to do with the movie. Yeah. We're talking about this dog.
Yeah, no, I mean, I really did think that it was more like watching Burn Notice, and you just think that the guy from Burn Notice is just playing the FBI agent instead of being sort of, kind of on the run from the FBI himself. So, yeah, it's very disappointing. What can I say? I don't call it total garbage because I can still watch Liam Neeson. But absolutely a huge disappointment.
All right, let's switch gears completely. Do you recall 1995's Richard Linklater's Before Sunrise, young Ethan Hawke, young Julie Delpy, meet cute on the train, walk across the city of Vienna in one night, a magical, glowing film? Well, if you thought that film was too Hollywood, too polished, and just too coherent, have I got a lo-fi mumblecore grad student project alternative for you? And I don't know if I can say the title. I might just call it Bleep House, but it starts with an S, if you know what I mean. What I can say is it's very authentic. It has a very authentic college feeling. I'll give it that. It's very indie. It looks like this guy called in a lot of favors. Cooper Rafe, mm-hmm. who wrote it, who directed it, who edited it, who produced it, and who cast himself as our lead man, our homesick man. Why, Hannah, is our protagonist having trouble adapting to college?
Well, I will just say that the title is crappy, and they should have picked a different title because I do think that that might work against it. Just like you said, I called this Before Sunset on a College Campus. Really is what it is. And so Cooper Rafe, he plays this lonely college freshman named Alex, and he's struggling to make friends and adjust to campus life. And then just as he's sort of contemplating, I think, a transfer closer to home, he goes to this, you know, big frat party type thing at the house. And he runs into his RA there, Maggie, and then they share, you know, that's where you're Before Sunset vibe kicks in. And, you know, they have this lovely night and they form this strong bond. They're walking and talking and then doing some, I'd say, R-rated stuff. It's all very magical until the next morning when Maggie blows poor Alex off. Awkward. And so, yeah, that's kind of where this film goes, except then hoping to rekindle that special connection, he returns to the shit house for another party, and more angsty drama unfolds. And ultimately, I would say the results are, you know, are bittersweet. And luckily, this ends with some hope for the future. This is not my cup of tea. This is an indie darling more than a mainstream movie. But it did win the 2020 Grand Jury Prize for Narrative Film at South by Southwest, which was COVID canceled, but these awards were still given out. So the South by Southwest people really, really like this film. And I do think that the Indian art house crowd would like it too.
This film is tailor-made for Austin, Texas, for that specific film festival. It's just, what I never understood is I don't know why this Texas boy, who is very close with his mom and sister, chose to go to school out in Los Angeles, where he had no connection, no family, no friends, no nothing. It doesn't explain why he did that, which is a very weak point in the script. Another weak point, Cooper Rafe. This is obvious. Alex is obviously him. A lot of this, I bet, is autobiographical. He is not a college freshman. Look at him. That's a man. That's not a college freshman. He blundered. He should not have cast himself. His direction's fine. It's raw. It's a first timer. It's very raw, but he should not have cast himself. He is not. I remember being a college freshman. I know what college freshmen look like. And that's a dude. That's a man. That's not a 19-year-old kid. I was going to ask you the obvious question. Will this title draw or deter eyeballs? I think I'm with you. I think it will deter. I think it was a stupid move on his part. I think he was trying to be provocative, and this is going to fail. That's not the way to go about it. That's a title a college freshman would come up with and think it's funny.
Well, and that's girl, what it feels like. It feels like a college freshman made, you know, somebody who's just starting out and gets all of their friends to help them make the movie overnight when they can get access.
Absolutely. I recognize the girl immediately, Maggie. She's played by Dylan Galula. She is Zan from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Jan Krakowski's stepdaughter in that show. She was, you know, a bit character who, you know, popped up for a couple episodes every now and again. But yeah, saw her right away. She plays just fine. I believed their relationship. Like, I can totally believe that, you know, a boy and a girl would connect for one night and then one of them would just blow the other off. I thought the movie was over. I bet you did too. And it kept going. There was you would call it an epilogue, if you will, flash to the future. And you can pick up what happened. And I don't think it served its purpose. I don't think it helped the film at all. I wish the film would have ended where I thought it ended. And it kept going for another 7-8 minutes, and that didn't help it. That didn't help it at all. And that needed an edit.
Yeah, I would say if they took this movie and changed the title and fixed the ending, then you'd have, I would say, a very strong indie for the up and coming auteur, which is really what I think. I don't think we've heard the last of Cooper Rafe. I think he's obviously multi talented. But I think he will learn from this experience, and I think that this film, even though it was a South by Southwest darling, will probably not get all that much traction.
No, and I think Richard Linklater was an obvious influence here. He might follow in his footsteps. I don't think we're going to get two sequels like that film did out of this.
After Shit House and Before Sunset, After Sunset. And then there was a third, wasn't there?
There was Before Midnight.
Okay.
Was the third installment in that film. No, I don't think we're going to get any more installments in this one. But I give it praise on authenticity. You know, the crappy roommate situation, the classes you're not connecting with, the alienation, he brought it off very well. A lot of college freshmen can start out that way before they find their group, before they find, you know, I know you're supposed to find yourself, but before you find your people, you know, you go to college and you're supposed to find your people, and he hasn't found his people yet. He wants Maggie very much to be his people, but she doesn't look like she needs people. So,
I had a little bit of a problem with, I guess she was supposed to be a sophomore RA, and an RA should not be having a one night stand with a freshman.
Well, you know, yeah, welcome to being an undergrad, Hannah.
But come on, the RAs, I think there are rules for the RAs. I mean, you know, come on. So I don't know.
It's better than honest thief.
But I didn't think she needed to be an RA. I think she could have just been another student. I think that would have been a little more believable for me.
Yeah, it gave her this tiny air of authority, sort of. I don't know. It didn't bother me so much that an RA might be shirking their sacred duties.
Yeah, but no, you're right. It probably ultimately is better than Honest Thief in terms of just filmmaking.
In terms of watchability and believability and everything ability, it's better than Honest Thief. All right, now you can get to that portion of everything I didn't watch this week, Hannah.
Well, there were a couple of things. So I did not expect you to watch Fly Like a Girl. It was a documentary that really was sent to me through Chick Flicks because it really is just a girl power chick flick doc. It's really just the target audience is all those girls out there and young women who just who are interested in flying. I mean, actually, because of your Air Force background, you might really enjoy this particular documentary. But it's for girls who want to fly in an airplane or on a shuttle or in combat. And so this documentary is really about helping those girls with their dreams take flight. It plays like one of those inspirational sports documentaries that, you know, encourages young athletes to really aim high even when the odds are against them. Only in this case, the sport really happens to be aeronautics. And so Fly Like a Girl shows this very diverse group of modern women who've made a mark in what has largely been, you know, it's been viewed as a man's world, but it also pays homage to some legendary female aviators who really helped pave the way. So you meet this little girl named Afton who collects them and creates airplane toys and mementos. She wants to be a professional flyer. And then sort of coming into the mix, you have talking heads with U.S. Senator and retired Army National Guard Lieutenant Colonel Tammy Duckworth. You've got a veteran astronaut, Nicole Stott. You have the national aerobatic champion, Patty Wagstaff, and America's first African-American female combat pilot, Vernice Armour. And so you just see all these different women talking about how they got to where they got. And so, you know, it's for the girls who are interested in STEM. And it's saying, hey, you know, you can do STEM and be feminine and just all of that and be very successful. And so I just think Fly Like a Girl, find it if you know a girl who is interested in flying.
Yeah, I've known plenty of female fighter pilots, and they were just as good as the guys in the squadron. So good on you.
Yeah, and the one issue I did have with it is you talked about how with Shithouse that you thought it had ended. It was very similar for me. There was at about the 65-minute mark, I truly thought that this documentary was over, and then it went on for like another 20 minutes or so. The information was interesting, but it kind of screwed up the pacing just a little bit. Unlike a very quick mockumentary that I think you should seek out that is now streaming on Hulu, it is called John Bronco. And boy, I wish I could tell you exactly what I saw, but I'm not really sure. But it's gosh darn amusing. It just really is. It's a mockumentary. It tells this story of the rise and fall and ultimate redemption of John Bronco, the legendary pitchman for the Ford Bronco. And I wasn't 100% sure that it was not a real documentary until Tim Meadows suddenly showed up as Bronco's manager. And then I'm like, okay, this is a joke. I get it now. And it, you're not quite sure because it just plays so authentically funny, kind of like the Marlboro Man, or I remember the Robert Conrad commercials where he's pitching Eveready batteries, just these rugged, golden age of advertising type guys. You've got jingles and guest appearances on Carson. And so it is a fun 37 minutes. John Bronco on Hulu. If you got 37 minutes to kill and you just want a a chuckle. This is a good one. It is probably just a publicity stunt for the Ford Motor Company, but hey, it's a fun little ride.
I think the most visible, the most notorious, the most widely known pitchman for the Ford Bronco was O.J. Simpson. That's the most famous Ford Bronco in history.
Yes, that's very true. And so they kind of, you just sort of have to forget about that. But this one's narrated by Dennis Quaid. So you have, and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is in there playing himself. And so Bo Derek plays herself, versions of themselves in this particular mockumentary. And I know that OJ's Ford Bronco is sort of where everyone's mind goes, but that's not what this one is intended to do. It's supposed to help you forget about that particular slow car chase. And it's really kind of celebrating the reemergence of the Ford Bronco SUV. And
is the Ford Bronco coming back?
I think it did come back. I think it is back or is coming back. So I think that's why this is coming out, is I think Ford actually helped helped bankroll this particular documentary. And it's from Imagine Documentaries, which is why I wanted to see it and thought it was real. Because Imagine Documentaries was, you know, that's the Brian Grazer and Ron Howard documentary company. And so, you know, you know that it's going to play like the real deal. And this thing already, it's got it. There's a website for John Bronco, got an Instagram page and a hashtag called Where is John Bronco? Because the whole idea is that he just kind of disappeared in his prime, and then they had to go track him down in Iceland, where he was like a bit of a hero. So I think you should check it out. I think you'd like it.
I probably would, but I'm not gonna.
Oh, come on. 37 minutes on Hulu. You can do it.
No doubt 37 minutes, but I'm gonna be an honest thief here, Hannah. I'm not gonna do it. This is not gonna happen.
Well, then here's another one that I hope you do see that I do. I really have to just encourage anyone who does not have Apple TV Plus, Apple Plus TV. I never even know which. I can never remember. Is it Apple TV Plus?
I think Plus
or
is
Apple
last. Plus is the last thing.
Okay, so Apple TV Plus will have, starting next week, and we can talk about it next week if you see it, but the reason I'm bringing it up is because it's available next Friday on October 23rd for streaming, and any Bruce Springsteen fan is going to want to either get a free trial of Apple TV Plus or just find whoever can get them access to watch this, because Bruce Springsteen's Letter to You is a gift to every Bruce Springsteen fan. It, you know, I enjoyed it more than the recent Western Stars documentary that they did with one of his albums. And I liked it more than the recording of his Broadway show, which I paid boku bucks to see on Broadway twice.
I remember when you did that.
Yeah. So this will release in conjunction with his new album, Letter to You. And there's 10 original songs that we see in this documentary. It's really him and the E Street Band in his New Jersey recording studio by his house, recording, doing their first full band live in the studio recording since Born in the USA. And you get to be this fly on the wall. And to be so prolific and still rocking out at age 71 is just freaking inspirational for anyone. And the songs are so good. You get context for each of these songs. It just leaves you with the warm and fuzzies. And I just want every Bruce Springsteen fan to just be ready to go ahead and watch this one.
Oh, then there's two reasons to get your trial or just go ahead and splurge Apple TV Plus membership. Because next week, Sofia Coppola is back with Bill Murray and Rashida Jones in the movie On the Rocks, which is on Apple TV Plus, the biggest thing I am looking forward to next week, the Rebecca remake on Netflix.
I keep hearing about this Rebecca remake, which I just have no interest in seeing. And all the Halloween movies that are kind of coming down the pike, no interest whatsoever for me. Life is a horror story right now. I don't need any of those. So that's why I will focus on the more uplifting, entertaining, wacky, whatever I can find. So yes, I will definitely see the Bill Murray one and Springsteen's Letter to You. So two big things coming out next week on Apple TV Plus. And hopefully you'll see Springsteen's, because I think, again, I think you'd enjoy it.
Remember, you're not everyone on earth is the biggest Springsteen fan that you are.
No, but I do think there's just something about being just in, you know, just any music fan. I think this is just a really, it's an homage to just being in a band and just the joy of making music with your bandmates. That's really very much what this one's about. And then also next week, we'll talk a little bit more about the Middleburg Film Festival movies that I am seeing. I know you you are taking this particular virtual festival off this year, but so far so good. I've seen two of the movies, one called Sylvie's Love, which is a romantic drama. It takes place in the late 50s, early 60s. If you like jazz, it almost felt like La La Land in reverse, because there's like these overtones of jazz, and the it's sort of a very sophisticated meet cute, and it goes backwards from they run into each other 5 years after their relationship had ended. So just like La La Land suddenly fast forwarded 5 years, I believe, at the end, this one sort of takes you to the 5 years forward mark and then goes backwards from there. So I really like that one with Tessa Thompson. And the other one I saw was called Herself. And that's with an Irish actress named Claire Dunne. And she plays this single mother who finally gets the strength to leave her abusive husband. And when she can't find affordable housing, she ends up building a house for herself and her girls. And it's really just about kind of building the foundation of a new life. And it's just a very, very good, solid, heartwarming, but sometimes tough to watch, but very, very good film.
All right. Well, let's bring it back around to the beginning, to the week's best film, to the one I hope everyone checks out, just because not only the entire pop culture world is going to be talking about this film, but you owe it to yourself to see this amazing ensemble cast and learn all about the trial of the Chicago 7. Truly an amazing, strong film. Go watch this movie, people.
Yeah, that really is the only one that's worth seeing right now for our times. And I do think Aaron Sorkin just can't go wrong. His writing is just so, so sharp. And that ensemble cast is phenomenal. Again, not the best directed film by Aaron Sorkin, but definitely the most, I would say, widespread interest to audiences out there, and very accessible. So hopefully, that's the one to go see, Trial of the Chicago 7.
That's it.
Yeah, that is it. And so until next week, where we, hopefully overlap on a few additional things, and then I'll also give you my feedback on the rest of the big ones that I see out of Middleburg. Until then, thanks so much for listening. As always, if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at The Cinema Clash on Twitter or thecinemaclash.com. In the meantime, stay safe, social distance, wear a mask, and don't forget to vote.
Thank you.
The Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell and Hannah Buchdahl is heard twice each weekend at 5:15 on Saturday and 12:15 on Sunday afternoon. Join us again next time for The Cinema Clash.